The year is 1991, and director Steve Miner of Lake Placid fame directs this story based on the true tale of Sonora Webster Carver. Set during the Great Depression, the film follows Sonora, a determined young woman who dreams of performing as a diving girl in a traveling stunt show, where horses leap from high platforms into water. Despite facing poverty, rejection, and later blindness after a tragic accident, Sonora refuses to give up on her dreams or her independence. Her courage and resilience inspire those around her, proving that strength comes from within. Now, this film highlights themes of perseverance, self-belief, and the power of following one's heart, no matter what the obstacle. Gabriel Anwar's heartfelt performance as Sonora, along with a touching score and breathtaking stunts, make Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken an inspiring story of bravery and unbreakable human spirit that defined the early 90s Disney films. This week on Back to the Balcony, we cover Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. And I kind of like put this on par with the early 90s films such as Newsies, which you brought to the show already. We had our discussion about that. We've talked about other films of this generation. I don't think we've talked about 8 Seconds yet, but like the early 90s seems to be that time where inspirational movies, not just from Disney, but other studios, really started kind of like becoming a thing, and they became almost cult classics of their own before the big CGI blockbuster special effects era of like 1993 and beyond kind of took them over. And this one always stuck with me, A, because I saw it in the theater, but being a child of the 90s, if I had a girlfriend or if there was like a party that girls were at, this almost was always on the TV. Reese Witherspoon's Man in the Moon was always on TV, and of course, your favorite Newsies. So that's why I brought this to the show. This was a first-timer for you, and I don't know, this kind of seemed like a Justin movie to me, at least that era of Justin movie. So what did you think?
This has Justin written all over it. I love a good forced emotion, motivational, inspirational Disney film, but I fucking hated this movie with a passion.
Interesting.
Mainly because, and I've never seen it before, but I remember the cover. When looking it up, I do remember the cover and skating by it. And I think at one point I may have saw this, but it is so forgettable that it is just unbelievable, because this is where I have a problem with this film. And I think, given Newsy some credit with Roger, this one probably left a bad seed in his mouth of where these Disney's White Fangs, this film, Newsies, all these epic motivational films come into play, left just a sour taste in his mouth, because we don't get the inspirational piece until the last 30 minutes and there's no background to it. We have to just wait and wait until this pointless romance, this predictable death scene, all this garbage in between to get us to this point where she becomes blind, she does one stunt, and then it's done. So there's nothing really to inspire us. It's just all situational, which drove me nuts. I wanted to giddy up this movie to get to the damn point.
Okay, so that's not what I expected from you, but I do have a retort, because your opinion is very similar to that of the critics. So the first thing I'll say is that to understand who this movie's audience is, you have to be familiar with the young adult novels of the late 80s and early 90s. Simple stories, simple characters, with one defining moment of tragedy that is going to bring the story together. Usually in, let's say, 120, 150 page novel, right? something that could be easily read in a day or in a classroom. This movie feeds that particular appetite of the 80s and 90s young adult novel crowd. Before young adult novels became full-on novels like the Twilight series, right? Where now you got adults reading these things. But the books that we grew up with, let's say books like Hatchet or My Side of the Mountain, things like that, they were the exact same thing just for boys. So I feel that this movie and the style of storytelling that it encompasses is a good representation of that time and that audience. Where I defend this movie is that there was an audience for it. There was an audience for this movie. It made more money than Newsies, and it had better reviews than Newsies did by most critics. It currently holds a 7.2 on IMDb, and it has like a 73% on Rotten Tomatoes. So it's a little bit better liked by multiple audiences. And I think the reason why is because it fed that appetite of that generation. Do millennials below and Zennials, or we're Zennials, do millennials and Gen Z know this movie? Probably not. And they're probably not interested in discovering it. It is on Disney Plus, but it's so, the cover is so just vague. I'm sure it just gets skipped by. This is like someone has to introduce you to this movie. But that's my defense of it, is that there was a time, there was a place, and there was an audience for this kind of movie, just like there was for those kind of, you know, young adult short novels. And that's where it lies. And it makes sense why the critics didn't like it, because it wasn't written for them. And unfortunately, it's not a well-made enough movie to get them past that perception. But because I grew up with it, and every girl I ever dated that was my age or slightly younger loved this movie, loved horses. So like I said, it's almost like you are immersed into it if that is the audience you're surrounded by.
You can completely judge a movie by its cover. And this is a vague cover because the movie is vague. It covers tough topics, especially for a true story. You have the Depression. You have a girl on her own that takes on a family and a death scene, and then the blindness. There are deep topics here that it just skates over. And you're absolutely right. It could be a young adult novel, but I think the young adult novel, if this was an interpretation, would have been a lot more detailed, especially when dealing with emotional topics that targets young youth, is to how we deal with these topics, how we deal with the death, how we deal with the poverty, how we deal with life struggles. These are the main intent of teaching young adults in a novel. Now, here we have a romance that spends a majority of the time that looks like the dude's like 40 years old dating an 18-year-old that we can absolutely...
Which he kind of is.
Which we, and again, in real life, they're like 10 years apart. But Disney knew this. That's why we don't see any heavy kissing scenes. We see hugs. We see all these soft, subtle moments between this romance when we could have focused on the overall relationship. We could have focused on the relationship between the horse. All we get here are pets of the horses or the diving scenes. We don't get anything internally with this girl. And in fairness, if this was targeted towards young females, young teenage females that just want a horse and a female to relate to, all fine and dandy. But there should have been something more to challenge the minds of our youth, to challenge the minds of going against the norm or challenging a physical disability. There are a lot more lessons than this movie lets on. And it's almost insulting to me that this movie skates over that. And I get it's the early 90s. I get it wants to be simplistic. I get that it wants to be that feel-good Disney movie. But we're missing the feel-good aspect. This movie didn't make me want to stand up and cheer unless it's based on the situation. So there's nothing that's earned here by the time we get to the climax. And that's the most frustrating piece of this, is I get what the target audience is, but it doesn't even touch the basis of what it could have been.
Yeah, but see, I think that's where the whole point of this movie is that it's palatable for its young adult audience. And I think that is why it does have such a loyal following. It's people that grew up with it. And I think that's one of the things that you and I have talked about before, where like Siskel and Ebert and I, and sometimes you and I disagree, where I feel like the idea of critiquing a film for a show like this, they were looking at the idea of like, this needs to be a movie that all audiences will appreciate. And I just don't think that this movie's intention was that. I think this movie had a very selected audience, the same way that, let's say, 1995's Mortal Kombat had a very selective audience. It was teenage boys, right? Why do teenage boys get a movie and preteen girls don't? Also, the respect that I have for Disney and other studios of the late 80s and early 90s still putting money and ideas into period pieces. And it's almost like I feel that they were really trying to make sure that eras in history and moments in history were not forgotten. If people were reading less and reading less about the Depression or suffrage and things like that, then let's make movies of these eras to kind of help remind them where we came from. And we don't get movies like that anymore because they're not going to make their money back in production, right? We always complain about CGI backgrounds, so they just don't make period pieces like this anymore that focus on the environment. I mean, they literally built Atlantic City in Georgia to make this thing work, right? And it's a beautifully shot film. It's got amazing production design and amazing sets and great costumes. And I think that's one of the things that I take into consideration, too, is that we don't get the respect of filmmaking, even in a little movie like this, these days. Or I'm going to say in like the last 20 years, like we just don't. So I appreciate films like this. I appreciate Disney to make movies about strong young women in this era. Journey of Natty Gann's another example, right? Like, who's the audience for that movie? But it still has an audience and people still talk about it. So what it does lack, let's say, in substance, I think it makes up for intention for the audience, for the young females, and whatever male fans get tacked onto it over time. I think that's a very important and a very intentional move by the studios, and they don't make that move anymore. And all we ever do now is complain about the lack of storytelling of films like this. And even though they're not great in a lot of instances, we miss them. And I think that's one of the main reasons why I brought this to the show. Is like, you will never get a movie like this anymore. If you did, it would be like an R-rated sexual exploration film, right? Like, they'd find some way to exploit the topic rather than prop up what the message is and what the story is. As for performers, I think the performances are great in this. They are shallowly written characters, but Gabriel Anwar is great. Cliff Robertson's great. It's a very stereotypical character. It was originally written for Burt Reynolds. And our boy Michael Schaffling, like we already talked about him going after too young of girls in our Mermaids episode. And here he is doing it again. Oddly enough, this was his last film. So he never had a chance to repeat that. But yeah, I mean, when I watch it now, all I wish is that Matt Dillon was that role. But you can't have everything.
I think it was his last film because Chris Hansen just popped up on the set and just say, you're done, dude. So enough. But here's kind of the deal. A year later, Newsies comes out and Roger gave a better review to this movie than he did Newsies. And I get Disney's intent. And when we talk about the filmmaking aspect, did Newsies tell a more inspirational tale? Did it tell the tale of individuals with a vast cast better? In my opinion, yes, because the main aspect of this movie, you have horses and you have a female lead. Neither one is focused on. We spend more time with the talking points of the males than we do the females. And I get there is probably a following to this movie. I really do. But Newsies did it better and has a better following because there are memorable aspects to that movie, not just the musical numbers, but the characters. Here, we don't have a memorable character. The main antagonist here is just one that is situational, that gives limited lines. It's like almost her dialogue is 1 to 2 sentences and then she's cut off and then everybody else has to support her. It's a good performance for what she has, but it's frustrating because we could have much more. Imagine if we had this true story told with every other Disney movie with one singular main character that has to react to these situations, that we spend 10 to 20, 30 minutes facing difficulties, facing situational challenges. This is, if we take the 90s to 1992, between White Fang, Newsies, this film, Shipwreck even, there's a pattern that we have with a singular character facing conflict. And we get a lot more in depth with that character. Between these 2 years, this is the one movie with a female lead that we don't get a focus on other than something that's situational. This is a good performance, like I said, but this is something that could have really stretched her legs in an actress that I absolutely love in the 90s. But this was a wasted opportunity as almost a standout role to really forte this actress in a Disney product.
Again, I don't think that's the intent. I don't think this movie was intended to make Gabriel Anwar a movie star. I think this movie was intended to get a female audience into the theater. Because, like you said, her character doesn't really have a whole lot of dialogue, but I think that really kind of plays into the theme of what the movie's trying to portray. She's an orphan. She's always being told that she's not good enough, that she's like a milestone around their necks, to shut up. And then she finds this family who essentially does the same thing to her and in a sense exploits her until she stands up and says, oh, I'm going to learn how to do this so you stop exploiting me. I think that the message is in the context of the movie, not necessarily in the dialogue or in the performance. The problem is, too, it's a short movie, so they only have X amount of time to tell that story. Because, again, movie making is a business. This isn't going to be a 2.5-hour movie to expect it to get its box office back or draw in a crowd of the audience that it needs. It needs to be tight. It needs to be short. I'm willing to bet there was probably like an animated Disney short ahead of it, but it was the 90s. That's what they did back then, right? I feel like there was probably a branch of Disney that had all of these historical fiction scripts, either based off of novels or obscure true stories that no one knew about. Newsies in particular. Originally, Newsies wasn't supposed to be a musical, probably sitting in the same stack of scripts, and that's where we got these. So, I I get it. You don't like the movie, that's fine. I like the movie, but I think what's more important than me liking it is the fact that there was a dedication to this kind of storytelling.
And I get the point of targeting an audience. I get that. But it's hard for me to accept this movie when you can tell the audience it's going for and it doesn't challenge that audience. And it's, again, like, I'll go back to my main point, is it's almost insulting that you put a horse and a female and you assume that audience is going to like it. And you just put that 20 to 30 minutes in at the end for that emotional stab at a tear, but it never gets there. And I don't want to say it's a horrible movie holistically, because to your point earlier, it is well shot. I hate the editing. The editing, especially with the stunts, are really cheap and they cut it off too soon. You get that stereotypical slow motion. You get probably 3 seconds of the horse diving. We don't get enough of that. But when it comes to the costume design, the music hits just right when you have that crescendo of the music as the horse is going, and then you just do the decrescendo of the dive with the cymbals going. So the music is there in Disney fashion. So there is an audience for Disney fans. Now, do I think that this was a huge hit for young females? I think young females, absolutely, because it is simplistic enough. But I think this one, as it aged, again, going to Newsies, like, gained a cult following. This one, I don't think had a cult following. It's kind of one of those that you see when you want to revisit your childhood. You remember vaguely this movie. You remember vaguely seeing it. But as an adult, I can't see somebody. It's like what we've said before. We've seen flaws as we get older. And this is one I think if adults revisit, they will see a lot of those flaws, because we spend an hour of build, mild build, to lead to just 20 to 30 minutes of meh.
It's a real interesting take on that. I mean, and again, it's totally subjective, because like I said, I know more people that love this movie than I know that love Newsies. The only people that I know that like Newsies are you and our friend Josh Scar. Honestly, you're like the only people I know that actually really like that movie. And to be a little bit of an asshole, I think that the cult of Newsies is more ironic than it is loyal. I think there's an irony to the, like the hipster irony of, I love Newsies, man, because it's a musical and, you know, it's a box office bomb. I get it, because I do the same thing with other box office bombs, just not Newsies. But yeah, and again, I think my point is, because I can, we both are kind of going back and forth on the same point, and that is, there was an audience for this, and it's still their audience. And I really honestly believe that this is a movie that, like, if moms that grew up with it show their daughters, or maybe even their young sons, they will create new fans. But you weren't raised with this movie, so you're looking at it from an outsider point of view, and you're immediately seeing the flaws, where people that kind of grew up with this, the flaws kind of become what the charm of is the movie, right? It's like, oh, that scene, oh, I forgot about that scene. But we're not going to write it off as a reason why the movie isn't, you know, palatable. I think that's a big difference there. Which, again, I will give total credit to our critics, where if you're going to judge this movie as an adult, adults are the ones buying the movie tickets, not kids. I can see why they didn't like it and why they wouldn't suggest it to an audience the same way that you're talking about right now. But, like, if my daughter had a bunch of kid friends over and they wanted to watch a movie and she was raised with it, I guarantee you if she put it on, those girls would probably attach themselves to it because it's new for them and they haven't been spoiled by society and spoiled by opinion and criticism like so many of us have.
I mean, Anne Ward here is kind of saves the movie. She's a cute character. She has the energy. Our critics will speak to that, and I agree with them on that. But as, like I said, as young kids, you might connect with it. You might connect with the energy it brings. And I think that's my main, would be my main takeaway, is kids will connect with the performances and the horses and a bright setting of the past. So there are elements here that will attract little kids. But I think as we grow, this one is mainly meant for little kids because this came from an era where we had young girls love Barbie. They love ponies. They love My Little Pony. The horse topic was at top of mind in the 80s and early 90s. So there is a lot to appeal at this time frame. So, but at the same time, what do they take away? And this is where I think Disney dropped the ball, is really attempting to tackle the females, the young girls, as an inspiration, because Disney focused on the male inspiration for live action. They assumed that only boys will enjoy live action, and they focused on the Disney princesses on animation. Where is their movie here? Is show us some struggles, show us something bigger. That's where I think I have the main problem, is the frustration that we have Shipwreck, Newsies, boy-focused movies, and live action, but we don't have anything of substance for young females at that time when it comes to Disney movies that's not animated.
Yeah, but I think that this movie covers all those bases. Like, she's an orphan. She runs away. She essentially eats scraps off of the carnival floor. She starts cleaning horse shit and then learns how to do all these things. Then she goes blind. I think there's lots of moments of struggle. I think, like I said, the movie's too short to really focus on those, but it covers all those things. And then, like, the age gap thing, I mean, like, I'm not a fan of the age gap of anything, honestly, but it is no different than any of the animated movies where the guy's literally in his late 20s or early 30s and it's a 16-year-old princess, right? Even contemporary films, like, for example, Tangled, like, it's her 16th birthday and Flynn Rider is easily pushing 30, right? Like, we still do that shit. It seems a little bit more uncomfortable in live action, and I'll grant you that, but it's following the exact same tropes that Disney was doing with its animated movie. So I'm not saying that is a wash and then it covers all its bases, but there's a theme there. So I don't think you should be able to, like, pick on one and not the other. That's kind of like my defense of that part. It still should have been Matt Dillon, but whatever. Yeah, okay, I totally get you. So how about we hear what the critics had to say about this?
It's one of those inspirational tales about a character with an indomitable will who overcomes an affliction. In this case, a young woman who is a stunt rider in a 1930s circus-like thrill show. She rides a horse that dives off a high-rise platform. I didn't want to see it. I guess it was a big deal back in the 30s. Gabrielle Anwar, a most appealing young actress, plays the girl who, when we first meet her, is an independent spirit at home. She runs away from home and joins a carnival stunt show led by Cliff Robertson. Now, there's nothing wrong, of course, about these kinds of stories. They can be inspirational, except that the bad ones often build up an interesting character just to lose them in the mechanics of the plot. Here it's a case of a fresh young female character being tossed aside in favor of that final dive and bang, the movie's over. And I sat there saying, what happened to the character? I wanted more of her. Just don't have her on a teeter-totter, blind, healed, you know,
yeah,
end of movie.
See, my disagreement with that is mostly his criticism of the end, because he's actually not too critical about the rest of the movie. He's really saying, hey, there are movies like this, and it's fine that there should be, blah, blah, blah. But where the movie goes, like, isn't the whole point of the film, to me, the fact that she finally masters something and then loses her ability to do it because of an accident and thinks that she'll never do it again? And the climax is she does it. Even if it's like the last time, it wasn't. She did it for like 11 more years. But the fact that they told her that she could never do it again, the fact that she could never see again, and then she has that one last jump that proves she could, I don't know what's wrong with my wiring where I find that inspirational and satisfying. And it's not overly dramatic and overly done. Because I feel that if this movie was 20 minutes longer and had more drama, you and they would probably be complaining there was too much of that and just get to the point already, you know? I feel this movie exists in a weird, very weird spot where it's hard to please two sets of audiences.
You're right on that, but here's kind of my take on it. Get rid of the romance. Give us 30 to 45 minutes of more of Anwar, of more of the struggle on it, because there is a lot here where she does have to overcome, but it is so brief to meet the runtime that we don't get to absorb it. We don't get to get any depth from her on the struggle. She attacks everything in a positive manner, which is great, which brings the energy. But there has to be something more to meet that positivity from this performance. And it, again, in an hour and a half movie, we spend an hour with a romance that I didn't care about. I don't know if young girls will care about. I can't speak to that. But I think this one really needed to show more scenes of struggle. I wish it would have been a half hour more. That way we could have extended a lot more struggle. And when we talk about she has to overcome the blindness, how many characters are saying she can't do it? One? Two? I mean, there is nothing here that she's going against the public. There's nothing here saying that she can't. She's going against the one true love that she has, saying, out of love, you can't do it because you're blind. And that's a natural reaction for somebody that you care about. But where is the struggle in the public's eye? It focuses so much in this movie on this carnival struggling. Where's the public opinion? That would have been brilliant to bring to this screen, to show some challenge to the public eye versus just the one you love. And that would have heightened the stakes when it comes to the final round, because when it comes to her blindness, we really only do get one scene, and it is literally less than a couple minutes. So that is where the inspiration lacks for me, is we have somebody that she loves saying that you can't do it naturally, but we needed more. That's where the inspiration comes, is a crowd saying you can't do it. Because I guarantee you, back in the 30s, when you have a blind girl riding a horse into water, there was more than just one individual that says you can't do it.
But again, I don't think that's the point of the movie. For one, the relationship, the romance, it's a proximity romance. They are carnies. They are vagabonds. They're not out there mingling with people. They literally fall in love with each other because there's no one else but them and the ringmaster of this thing, right? So it's a proximity relationship and romance, and she feels like she belongs because she's spent her life as an orphan not feeling wanted by anybody. And two, it speaks to the time of, let's say, the masculine and male dominant idea of relationships and marriages, where it's like he essentially, and they talk about this in the movie, is putting his foot down. He's telling her no, right? That's the other part. They don't want to make him too much of an asshole, but that's the conflict. It's not what the audience expects or wants. It's the fact that he didn't even really want her doing this to begin with once they started this relationship because, A, he didn't want her to get hurt, but B, it's kind of like she's outshining him. And now he has this new ego after his father passes on and gives him the business, and he's not a good businessman. She's the one that essentially kind of figures out how to get more out of it. So I think that's the other part, too, of the story, that she is not just fighting the idea of the blindness and the conflict of never being able to do what she loves again and entertain and be connected with the horses. She's fighting the so-called patriarchy as she's doing it. Because it's a Disney movie, they're not putting that on the front page, but that's the subtext. That's what it's about. It's not about what the audience expects. So that's where I do think that it is an empowering movie for young women, because they're going to look at that guy and be like, hey, we get that you love her, but stop telling her that she can't do it, because that's not the point. You should be embracing it. What else is he going to do? Go sell aluminum siding? Like, she was the star of the show. In reality, because I come from the entertainment world, if she never did it again, he probably would have left her somewhere and found another girl to start diving, and then all that just kind of like goes away. But that's not romantic. So I think that there is a lot in the subtext. I think it just takes the right kind of audience to see it, but not even see it. It takes the right kind of audience to appreciate it.
No, to an extent, because there is some subtext to it. And even we get from Robertson having a discussion in the beginning of the movie with his son of the line, she's too young.
And he hides the letters. He knows.
And he hides the letters. Absolutely. He does the old trope of hiding the romance because he knows it's forbidden. But again, when it's addressed again, did you get my letters? No? Okay. Let's move on. There's no question to it. There's no conflict to it. It just is one of those. It's a slideshow of situations. And this is where it just skims over a lot of the topics. It would have been better writing if we took a singular topic of a girl and her horse that we see a lot of movies, especially lately with animated movies, of just a relationship between the girl and the horse. Why do we have to have dialogue in a Disney movie that says she's too young? Move on. Cut it out. It's pointless. Why do we have to have hidden letters and a proposal at the end? Cut that shit out. Talk about inspiration when it comes to overcoming challenge. It's challenging enough to train a horse. It's challenging enough for anybody to grow as an orphan to have a profession. All these are real challenges. Why does everything have to have a romance? It drives me batshit crazy, even to today, from the 90s to now.
Because it's Disney, and you can't have Disney without melodrama.
Disney, I get it.
Melodrama is what fuels the Mouse House. Even in its non-romantic movies, you have to have melodrama.
Like, you don't really get that in Shipwrecked. You don't really get that in some of the Disney movies. Like, control yourself, Disney. Just let these characters face some challenges. It's a true story. I don't fucking know. It's,
I mean, if it makes you feel better, the real Sonora got to experience the theatrical release and she hated it. So, you know, but she hated it because she hated it, not because it wasn't inspirational. She hated it because they made her husband seem too mean or something. Like, it was not a true enough story for her, and I get it. But she liked the music and the inspiration. Anyway, Roger jumps in.
I know what you're talking about. Gabrielle Anwar is the actress's name.
Good.
And she is very fresh.
Yes.
And you said she was appealing. She has a wonderful natural quality on the screen. Open, confident, good energy.
Yeah.
I liked her. I'd like to see her in other movies. I felt in this film the plot was so manipulative.
Yeah.
I was sitting there calling everything. I mean,
yes, you when did. When you
get a development at one point, you know that something else is going to happen. Cliff Robertson looks a little pale.
Well, that we know what's going to
happen. We know what's going to happen next. Yeah. And then, of course, the rest of the movie is just as predictable. And so I felt as if the characters and all their spontaneity were all trapped at the service of this very manipulative plot about whether she'll get back on this horse again. And what do you think the odds are that she will?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that they are completely disavowing the idea that this is a formulaic Disney film, which there are literally hundreds of. And of all those hundreds, so many are not good, like not even watchable. This one is different. Like, this one is watchable. This one actually gives a shit. And because it's not made to be like the second feature of a Disney double bill, it's meant to be an actual movie, but it's playing to those audiences. And if we look at this, we already talked about it at the start of the episode, this early era is essentially like the death nail in this genre of filmmaking for Disney. I mean, practically live action too. Like, they kind of like, we need to go back to the drawing board. You get a few years off of the early 90s and then you come back with Flubber, right? And Jungle to Jungle and all that goofy bullshit. They stopped doing movies like this because they didn't see the return and they felt the audience had grown past it. And they weren't wrong. But it's better than what these guys think it is if you think of it in the realm of that Disney formula. And I think they are looking at it as a film that all adults are going to enjoy and not a film that they're going to bring their teenage or preteen girls to that they can share a moment of inspiration and accept the fact that it is a little hokey, a little melodramatic, a little cheesy. But again, that's kind of what it's supposed to be.
This is one I think Disney should have just kept their hands off of, because I think this is where Gene and Roger are really hinting between the lines is, when you have a story, you have to cut out the death scene. The camera can't even go to the man passed away. You have to have a zoomed in reaction of Sonora. You can't see the dead man. You can't see the 40-year-old man kissing the 18-year-old, whatever it may be. You have to have hugs. You can't see the difficulty, the medical piece of it, of her going blind. There is a lot of censorship here when it comes to what Disney's trying to do to tell this inspirational tale. But there is a story here that can be inspirational, but I think this one should have come out a lot later without Disney Studios trying to kind of dumb it down to just everything is happy, everything is great, even if you're blind, even if you're in the depression. That doesn't work here. This is something a different studio should have focused on, increased it by 30 minutes to 45 minutes, and actually told a true tale. So this is where I think Disney executives put a bunch of true stories on the table, and they saw a horse and a young girl, and they said,
yeah,
that's it. This is what we're going to tell. Green light. So I think it's a missed opportunity, and we don't say this often, and I don't say this often, but I want to see more of this true tale, because I think there is more to this story other than just fluff. And I think Roger and Gene nail it when it comes to the pure 30-second definition of this film.
I don't disagree with that take. I think when it comes to the criticism of the movie, my biggest gripe about their criticism is that there's not enough of it. And I feel that's something that we are seeing in a lot of these kind of like later episodes of the late 80s into the 90s, whereas if they don't feel like the movie challenged them in any way or challenged the audience in any way, they breeze past it so quickly that it makes it feel like it's not even a part of the show. I mean, go back and watch this full episode. They spend a good 4 or 5 minutes on each movie and they kind of blow past this one. So I think that is one of my concerns of how I'm going to rate Gene here, is that since he brought it to the show and he was one that kind of set it up, even in his description of the movie while the clips are playing, he doesn't have a lot of valid critique in there. He is really just kind of waiting to pass the baton to Roger, who he knows this is going to agree with him. And at the end of the day, the only thing that I get of substance from this Gene critique is that it's cliched, stereotypical, and predictable, and it ends on a very quick note, the end. Nothing about the movie besides that. And that's, I guess, okay if you don't care about the movie, but your job is to tell us more about the movie. So I can't disagree with him on some of those critiques, but as a critique itself, as a whole, I think it's lackluster. I give it a C, not because he didn't like the movie, but because I feel like we got any information, any valuable information or suggestion or critique from that statement that he made. He pretty much just walked past the movie.
You know, it reminded me with both of these reviews, especially with Roger, when they reviewed 1997's Masterminds with Patrick Stewart, which was a very generic Home Alone ripoff kind of thriller, where on their show they said, while we were prepping for the show, we forgot the name of the movie. We forgot anything about this movie. And I think it was like a under a minute review of
wasn't
this
film.
Wasn't
that on the Fallen episode that we did? Wasn't that on that same episode? Yeah, because I listened to it afterwards. Like, I got to go back and watch Mastermind.
Which, guilty pleasure. But anyway, so I think this is where, and I've been there, where it is so hard to get excited for a movie review that kind of just stays between the lines. It's very linear. It's very meh. So without energy put into it, and again, with some good performances here, there's nothing more than that. So I agree with you to an extent that there is nothing other than we can predict what happens. Good for you. I get right. that, but tell me.
You've seen a movie or two, so you know what's coming.
Who hasn't seen a Disney movie at this point to know what's going to happen? When Disney comes out with a movie that takes me by surprise on predictability, then that should get an Academy Award. So anybody that goes to a Disney movie after 30, 40 years, whatever it may be at this point, you should know what you're going to get. So I do agree with you on that, is we needed more. Did it do the job that it needed to do? That's what we needed to hear from our critics when it comes to the age gap. And I'm guilty as it is right now. I am, because I can't relate to this audience and I can't see an audience reaction at that time because I didn't see this movie. But this is where I will contradict them numerous times, is they always said you cannot base your criticism on an audience reaction. Bullshit, you can't. Because you know what? If you're in this kind of movie and you're getting a good audience reaction and it's not your age gap, you are going to depend on an audience reaction, because if that audience is reacting more than you are, then you're crotchety and you're not getting what it's throwing down. So to me, I think you're absolutely right that they, along with me at this point, don't match what the movie was intended for, the audience it was intended for.
And if there's one thing that I can say that, like, my goal of this particular episode and bringing this movie to the table is exposure. You know, it's something that us in our, you know, 40s now, our older millennial, zennial age, that I feel like there's so many things that are just kind of disappearing from our childhood and things that people never discovered. And for me, this is one of those movies. Now, am I like preaching at the, you know, the pulpit that Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken is the best movie ever? No, by no means am I doing that. But I think that there is a responsibility for us having this exposure show to let people know that these movies did exist and that this was an era and genre of filmmaking that we probably won't see in this style ever again. And so I think it is worth it for an audience, especially people who are learning to love film or film criticism, to kind of go back and see what these movies did. I think that's my biggest message and mission of this particular episode, is like, no one's seen this except for people like our age or younger, like, or older. Like, go see this, like, watch it. It's on Disney Plus. Everyone's got it. Just give it a chance. It's barely 90 minutes, and see what you think and see what filmmaking was like back then. And if you don't like, you never have to watch it again, or it might be your new favorite movie, right? I feel that's what I do on the Cult Worthy. And this was kind of like my agenda for this one too, is like, hey, this is a movie that doesn't get talked about at all. Let's talk about it.
And I think this is one of those Disney movies you put on a Saturday, Sunday afternoon on a rainy day. It's one of those subtle movies that, you know, you can just stare at. I'm not saying it's a horrible movie, but my preference, I can't rewatch it because I need to get something out of inspiration. And for me to say that, where I'm a sucker, you know this, for inspirational movies, forced emotion movies, you know what? If you do the job and you do it on an average level, I'm bought in. But this one, I can't get bought in. And you know what? Maybe I'll show it to Brooklyn and maybe I'll show it to my son and maybe they'll have a different reaction. I should have done that before the show. But for me,
I'll tell you what, I'm more emotionally invested in this film and the relationships portrayed in this film than I am The Notebook. Like, I think The Notebook is dog shit. I'd rather watch this than The Notebook.
No. If you cried over this movie versus The Notebook, you have no soul, sir. It is impossible not to cry at The Notebook in the final act.
I couldn't cry in The Notebook because my eyes were too far rolled back into my head to allow the tears to escape. So, anyway, that's a different conversation.
Stop it.
All right, so I gave my critic his review. What's yours?
You know what? I'm going to give him a 2 stars because I do agree with you on the critique on it. It doesn't give enough, and there's a lot to talk about because I think on this episode, it's one of our longer episodes, so there is a lot to deep dive in this movie that I don't think it deserves it, but our critics should have given something more because it's a children's movie. It's a family movie, and they should give the reasons why a movie in particular like this shouldn't buy a ticket for. So there should have been a lot more movies since there's going to be a lot more audience going to attempt to see it.
Right. The juxtaposition of the fact that one of our longer conversations for literally our shortest review from Siskel and Ebert at a minute 40, and it's one of our longest conversations. They just kind of walked all over it. There's much more to discuss. So anyway, cool. Well, I'm glad you watched it. And like I said, I'm surprised by your opinion. But at the same time, I totally get where you're coming from with it. I think we're just in two different worlds of appreciation for this kind of cinema. And that's totally fine. But they should have had a better conversation about it. So anyway, next week, Justin's bringing to the table, before we're getting ready for our 100th episode celebration, which we're still kind of working out the kinks on that one, he's bringing a nostalgia classic, just like this one is for me. I'm sure it is for him. I've got a lot to say about it. Good or bad, we'll find out. He's bringing Dirty Dancing to the show. The Jennifer Grey, Patrick Swayze classic with the classic soundtrack that everyone in my age range owned on vinyl when I was a kid. It was like literally everybody had that soundtrack. So I'm curious to see what your thoughts are. I kind of already know what your thoughts might be, unless you totally come out of left field and surprise me. But I'm actually really excited to talk about this one because this is a perennial watch for me. I watch it every year. I've already watched it once this year. I'll watch it again.
It's also a shocking review that those that haven't seen the review are going to be pushed back by it for such a known film. And
yeah, I've never seen the review, so I'm excited.
Yeah, it's going to be a great conversation, and you knew it was coming. We can't leave baby in the corner not talking about this movie. Had to put it in.
Excellent. All right, so everyone, please rate, review, and like and subscribe our show on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify. Jump over to YouTube and subscribe, like, rate, review our show there. Give us some suggestions of films that you'd like to hear us talk about, as long as they were covered on Siskel and Ebert during the Gene and Roger years. You can find all of my stuff, Antonio, the host of The Cult Worthy, over at thecultworthy.com, and you can find my co-host Justin Henson over at
themoviewire.com,
and we will see you next week.
See you next week.